Hey guys, this is Beth Golay. And before we get started with Marginalia, I just wanted to say that KMUW's podcast platform is made possible by High Touch Technologies, a software technology and business communications company that provides products, services, and support to all industries. High Touch brings the human touch to technology with a world-class team of industry experts. Learn more at hightouchtechnologies.com. And now, here's Marginalia.
This is Marginalia, a production of KMUW Wichita.
Marginalia, notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes which are incidental or additional
to the main topic in the margin of a book.
Short story collections can be difficult to discuss in one sitting, but that doesn't stop me from trying. Luckily, with his new collection, author Ben Nickel linked together some of his stories through characters and circumstances. Ben stopped by the KMUW studios recently to visit with me about the new collection, Sun River. I'm Beth Golay, this is Marginalia, and here's our conversation. Sun River is a collection of 10 stories, and I'm kind of curious why these 10. Is there a tone or a theme that runs through them?
Yeah, Sun River came out from Black Lawrence Press a couple months ago this summer, and it's a collection of 10 stories, five of which trace the progression of one family over about 20 years, and the other five of which deal with similar characters and in similar circumstances, but not characters directly related to the family. And if I were going to put all the stories or most of the stories into one bag, these are stories about people who have already undergone what is probably going to be the defining tragedy or trauma of their lives. And the result of that is they have to go forward and do something now because they're still alive. But after such a trauma, the parameters of a character's life and of a person's life change so much that they find themselves in a sort of expanse, or at least I believe this. And on the one hand, as horrifying as that is, and it is horrifying, it's also in a dark way very liberating because all of the prior constraints have been erased. The rules that a character has been playing by are out the window. And so, in a word, Sun River is about characters who are largely doing what they want, but in a vacuum and not finding what they want. And in terms of where the stories take place, I think plays into that as well. A lot of these stories take place in open, expansive areas in the Mountain West, and they can do or say whatever they like and to a large extent behave how they like, but it's going to be hard to find whatever it is they're looking for.
Some of these stories have connections, but because of the different perspective, we don't really realize. I mean, I'm assuming like the first story, Opening Night, we don't really know any of the characters' names. But then later, was it
Afterlife.
Afterlife. I mean, that's the same family where Connor and Dawn and Angie actually have names now.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
And there's,
I'm an idiot. Okay,
no,
go ahead.
No, and that's by design too. You know, I didn't want it to be a novel. I wanted these stories to have their own life, but have this background through line, I guess, where you can, once you're keying into these being the same people from the same family, that you can sort of see the pulse of this being part of a bigger story. But I didn't want them to be so sutured together that they didn't really have breath from each other. So the only way that you know at the outset of a story, or might know at the outset, that they are part of the family through line is those are the only five dated stories. But other than that, I wouldn't know either if I hadn't written them. Wouldn't have known initially.
So how do you determine points of view? Because, and I never seem to identify them correctly, like first person, second person, third person, limited. How do you decide when you're writing the story how it's going to be told?
Good question. That decision is never made the same way twice, I don't think, or made with the same criteria. Even sometimes it's just a character who, just by virtue of his or her voice, is compelling enough that I want to hear them say it. And when I say compelling, it usually means they're the worst one in terms of how they act and how they think. So if it's a compelling enough voice, that might sort of bring my eye over to where they're standing. Or if it's if the view that they have of events seems particularly insightful or moving to me. So there's one story. It's not one of the family sequence, but there's one story in the book called Tenants. And that whole story came out of this idea that I wanted to tell a story that was about watching a story. The story takes place on a small lake in Idaho. And the person telling the story is a landlord who lives across the lake from the cabin he's leasing out. And the tenants who come to live there, it's their story. And of course, it throws light back on the landlord's story, but mostly it's his experience of watching a story from maybe a quarter of a mile across the water. That one, the point of view sort of spoke on its own. It was pretty clear what it had to be.
How do you attack character development? I mean, some of your characters are much older than you are. Sometimes the main character is a woman. How do you get into their heads?
Yeah, you know, well, first off, I'll say I hope I do it well, but because they're not necessarily people like me, or at least people with my background or age, or if it's a woman, I don't know if I do. Different writers think differently about this, and there are some writers, I think they have a point, that sort of insist that a writer shouldn't write from the perspective of or write the story of characters whose stories they don't have some sort of claim to. And I get that, and I try to respect that line, but also I don't want to write stories about people that are just me. You know, I sort of have my stories that I can tell myself. I want to think about what people from other, who have, you know, walked through life differently and seen and felt and thought different things. I want to share that for a while. So, was your question, how do I go about trying to do that?
Yeah. I mean, how do you get into the head of female narrator?
Well, I try to hold very still for a long time and then ask myself, and I don't try to draw on any specific knowledge or certainly not research. I just try to hold still for a long time and think, this moment, knowing everything I know about this character and what's going on and what they're trying to do, how does this feel? And try to build that feeling into myself and then see what I start typing. And then it's a matter of doing that in a cyclical way again and again, day in, day out, and sort of getting rid of stuff that seems like a misstep. And hopefully the end product feels legitimate to me, but again, it's still just me. So I don't know how well they land to someone who might see a little bit more of themselves in that character.
We'll talk about seeing a little bit more of themselves. There was a story, Assisted Living, that hit a little close to home with this description. Well, Gwen's posture was poor and portions of her midsection lumped and bulged. The skin under her eyes sagged badly, and throughout her face ran awful furrowed wrinkles as if God had scored her with a box cutter. And sometimes the truth can be ugly. And I saw myself in that.
I don't think you should see yourself in that. But also, maybe you should insofar as Gwen is the hero of that story. And that description, it's worth noting too, comes from her husband, who is the character telling that story. And that description is early in the story too. But what that story is, this is a couple. It's not part of the family sequence, but this is a couple who are going through a divorce or just at the cusp of divorce, and they're late middle age. But what happens, what precipitates the story anyhow, is that Gwen's grandmother, who lives in an assisted living facility, is going to get married again. It's been a number of times. And this grandmother has been a source of strength and inspiration for Gwen for her whole life and helped her climb out of a family situation that was unfair, to say the least. Mark and Gwen go to this wedding together. They go to Gwen's grandmother's wedding. And Mark is the sort of wounded partner in a relationship who knows that he's out the door for whatever reason. And he doesn't cop to this consciously to himself, at least not at the beginning of the story. But the only way he can think of to preserve his marriage is to try to break down whatever strength is enabling Gwen to get out of the marriage. And that happens to be the grandmother later in the story. But also from that description you read, he just has, at this point, having built that mentality into himself, he's going to see Gwen in this vicious way from the beginning.
You know, there's a sadness to these stories. I mean, there's heartbreak, then, and then there's, you know, laugh out loud moments, because Mark had me laughing out loud a couple of times. But then there are unimpeded looks at the human condition. Is your writing influenced by any specific author, or do you have any authors that you look up to?
Yeah, a lot. To your first question there, I'm glad that Mark and some of the other less admirable characters also made you laugh, because that's something, if any character, but particularly the character saying a story, if this is going to be a person we don't like, then there had better be lots of what they say that we like despite ourselves, because you don't want to sit down with a story for an hour and just hate. So I'm glad to hear that. And in terms of authors that I look up to, the first book I ever read that made me think, I want to do this, was A River Runs Through It by Norm MacLean. That was sort of the first book that got me thinking, yeah, this is a pretty neat thing to do. And that was in high school. And then in college, I started getting into more hilarious comic writers. Thomas McGuane was a writer and is a writer that I really looked up to for a long time. After college and getting into grad school and then moving out into the world, the writers who were too purely comic started to wear a little bit thin for me, and writers who were a little bit more mysterious and earnest started to catch my attention. So Dennis Johnson is a writer that I have looked up to for a long time. Charles D'Ambrosio is another one, and especially with D'Ambrosio's approach to craft. So he's, I don't know exactly how old he is. I think he's around 60. He's been writing his whole life, and he has two collections of short stories. You know, he's just meticulous about it. I'll give you an example. I'm a person who, when I find a song that I like, it's going to be on repeat in my car for a couple months before I even listen to the next song on the album. And for a long time, I was that same way with the writers that I loved. But I think in the last maybe 5 to 10 years, I forced myself to read as much as I'm a slow reader, but to read as much as I could get my hands on and try to find or be open to whatever that author has to show that I did not know or had not experienced before. And so I've always tried to move on, you know, from the writers that I know I like. And of late, I've been finding a lot of contemporary writers who really knock my socks off. So Tommy Orange's book that came out last year, There, was just incredible. Otessa Moshfegh's short stories, in particular, Homesick for Another World, I thought those were terrific. But I also am trying to go back and read writers whom I didn't like in college and earlier. I want to see if I can appreciate that now. One writer that fits that description is Jim Harrison. I really didn't like Jim Harrison for a long time, but I read the novella Legends of the Fall last year, reread it after many years, and my jaw just fell off. So that's a few, but the list is long and growing.
I was thinking as I was reading this, there's not a lot of alcoholism, but this really feels like Raymond Carver to me.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't mention him, but yes, I love Raymond Carver. There's a little bit of alcoholism in the book, but I love Raymond Carver, and I actually think, I mean, I loved Raymond Carver before I read anything by Charles D'Ambrosio, but Charles D'Ambrosio is sort of also a window into Raymond Carver. They're from the same region. D'Ambrosio is a great admirer of Carver's work, and I don't want to say they're similar kinds of stories, but I view them as similar artists.
Do you have a favorite story in the collection?
Yeah, that's hard. I do. Afterlife is my favorite story in the collection. The reason for that mainly being that by the time we get to that story, it's the last one in the family sequence. And by the time we get to that story, I believe that all the characters of that family, not just the surviving characters, and not just the ones that the story pays the most attention to, all the characters in the family are brought to bear on that story. So when I wrote that and when I read that, I feel, to whatever extent it's possible, the family's sort of whole again, or at least all in the same room. And so it was a pleasure to write because of that. And it's part of the reason I like reading that one too.
Okay, so besides Sun River, you have two other books published, is mm-hmm. that right? And your stories and essays have appeared in many literary magazines. Do your stories ever change from, you know, publication to publication, or publication in a magazine to book, or do you consider them complete?
So do you mean?
If something has been published somewhere and then it shows up in a collection, has it changed?
Yes. I would imagine, I'd have to check on this, but I would imagine in the case of every story from both of my collections, that's true. And, or at least every story that appeared in a literary journal before being in the book. And I would suspect if I were asked to go through and edit those stories again, all, whatever it is, 20 of them would change again. You know, I just think that you, maybe not, but I think that, well, I know it's the case going from a literary journal to the manuscript version. It's the crossing the same river thing. I mean, a story just will not look the same to me a month or 2 months or a year later. And sometimes I like the story a lot better than I'm expecting to like it. Sometimes I get a little worried to read something that I wrote a while ago. But even in that case, there's going to be something, the way that a sentence turns or a word choice or just even, you know, the posture of a character or something, something's always going to change. For my own sake, for my own sanity, I have to pretend they're done and written in stone, or else I would sort of always be wringing my hands about that, I think.
I can't recall the first author of a story collection who told me that they change all the time. You know, I published it here and it was this, and then they made it into an episode of Selected Shorts. And he's like, I had to add 30 pages onto it just for that. And so I've asked every short story writer since then, and you all say the same thing. And I find it fascinating that, you know, once I call something done, it's done. But I love how these stories seem to be more fluid.
Yeah, but like you, I need to call it done. And I think for that very reason, just knowing that there's always some tweaking that can be done. You know, a story sort of exists on the page as long as there's a page, but I'm getting older. So I need to move, things are done and I need to write something else.
So you were part of the creative writing faculty at Wichita State. So I want you to talk to me a little bit about that. And like, how do you balance writing and teaching and living?
So I moved to Wichita just over a year ago. I'm in my second year at Wichita State. And I can say that it has been much easier to strike that balance that you're talking about here than other work situations that I've had. So I've been really lucky ever since grad school to be teaching to some extent, not always teaching creative writing, but always teaching something at a college. And that allows some schedule flexibility and certainly, you know, summers and breaks off. But being at Wichita State in particular, so I'm teaching all creative writing and lit classes and spending a lot of my time working with our MFA students who themselves are developing their own stories and putting together and sending out their own manuscripts. And there's a, so far anyway, you know, I'm in my second year, like I said, but so far I found it to be really symbiotic. I write in the morning and then teach and do campus stuff in the afternoon generally. But I find that, you know, writing alone in my basement at my house, a lot of questions and thoughts about writing turn up. And Amy, my wife, who is an English teacher, a high school English teacher, she's a great person to, you know, share these ideas with. But I'm also lucky enough to, in terms of where I get my paycheck, to be able to go into a room and share these ideas and hear other ideas like them from a lot of pretty talented students. So it's working out really well. I'm really happy at Wichita State.
That was Ben Nickel, author of the short story collection, Sun River, which was published by Black Lawrence Press. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. Discover more episodes at kmuw.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Marginalia is produced at KMUW Wichita. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen, and I am the producer. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.